Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder wants more than $1 billion in additional funds to pay for road and bridge repairs across the state. We've certainly been hearing those headlines. Just how that money will be raised has been on the front burner in Lansing. But on today's show, we go beyond that debate, and we look further down the road to another question. Just how would that repair money be spent? Who'd get it? Who decides the fair way to divvy up transportation funding in Michigan? And then later in the hour, we chat with Michigan author and poet Keith Taylor, and we get his recommendations for good springtime reads. But first, a letter has gone out to four of the most powerful names in Congress: Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Speaker John Boehner, and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi. The letter contains a call for immigration reform, and the people who wrote that letter are 56 young state and local elected officials, including State Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from the 6th District. Representative Tlaib joins us now from Lansing. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So you joined with other state and local elected officials from 23 states in the District of Columbia, and everybody is aged 35 or younger. And what are you young elected officials saying to those four big names in the Senate and House?
You know, as young elected official, part of a young elected officials network, we see firsthand on the ground. When we say elected official, we're talking about city council members, school board members, state representatives, county commissioners. We all see firsthand the impact of the failing immigration system that we have in the United States. And we have to always be able to pick up those pieces. So we're really eager to see the federal government step up and the members of Congress step up and actually fix our broken immigration system.
And you and the 55 other elected officials, as you say, you are right there in the trenches. What do you fear that those big leaders in Washington are not getting and not understanding about the 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country?
That they're here already, that they're already part of our communities. You know, my aspiring citizen neighbors, and I do have neighbors that are stuck in a system where they can't get work authorization, where they can't feel that they can walk through the community without being profiled and asked for their documents. I see those aspiring citizen neighbors every single day contribute to our communities. They are cleaning up our parks side by side with us. They are participating in trying to reform our education system. And it's about time that we recognize they exist and give them the respect that our country as Americans that we truly support, which is our core values of fairness and opportunity. And I hope that the members of Congress understand how important it is to focus on the American values that we have.
Of course, your own family experience is like those of so many immigrant families. Can you tell us more how this influences what you're trying to say and do about immigration reform?
Absolutely. You know, as a child of immigrants, you know, I sit in the state legislature and I've been asked for my birth certificate in committee as a joke. I have seen my brothers and sisters targeted because we're growing to become very anti-immigrant, even though many of the people targeted are U.S. citizens. And it's about time that our members of Congress recognize that delaying or not addressing this important critical issue is going to hurt us in the long run, not only our economy, our communities, but just our society in general. Our neighborhoods are suffering. I can't stand it when I see yet another home in the city of Detroit empty because a family member was deported just because they had to wait 10 more years before they were able to be able to get their green card. There's something wrong with a system that doesn't support the need for family unity, the need for supporting our economy. I can tell you our state's education system attracts many foreign students, contributing over $600 million a year to our economy. You know, Michigan alone can be much more welcoming, and immigration reform is going to help us, and it's going to thrive our economy, thrive our neighborhoods.
I'm speaking with State Representative Rashida Tlaib, who's a Democrat from the 6th District. She and 55 other young elected officials, state and local officials, wrote a letter to four of the most powerful names in Washington. You hear the names Reid, McConnell, Boehner, and Pelosi, and you know those are very, very heavy hitters, calling on them to help lead the way in the reform of our country's immigration policies. And I wonder, Representative, would you ever run for Congress? Would you want a seat at the national conversation in action for immigration reform?
Absolutely. You know, as local elected officials, we are on the ground every single day. And I can tell you, as a member of Young Elected Officials Network for almost 5 years now, you know, us as progressives have talked about beyond legislation, beyond ordinances, beyond our power at trying to address, how are we going to fully elevate the voices of our residents? And this letter recognizes what we do as a network in getting together and educating our members of Congress that we are struggling to address this issue because we don't have that much power to make the necessary reforms. They do. And they need to understand when they come back home and see a city that is being destroyed by increasing of militarizing our northern border here in Detroit, and talking about the kinds of stop and asking people for documents, how that makes the child in the backseat feel. We are picking up those pieces.
How have you done, Representative Vogt? Let's talk about those faces that you see when you're in Lansing. What are you doing in terms of reaching out to some of those Republicans and trying to kind of share ideas and reach some understanding?
Yeah, I can tell you right now we've gotten some movement on supporting bilingual education. And it took me, you know, finding out in a particular Republican district. My colleague on the other side of the aisle represents about 25% Latino community, and his school district is about 25%, where mine is in Detroit Public Schools, it's about 30%. And, you know, that doesn't even count the Arab American community and the Asian American community and so forth. And we've now decided we're going to take this off the table and actually have a conversation about it. And it took me, what, about 4 years now? But we're finally having a conversation about the need to support supplemental programs, special education kind of programs for those that English is their second language.
And who is that that you're working with? Who is that that you're working with?
Oh, that's with Representative Joe Haveman.
Okay.
So Representative Joe Haveman and I represent diverse communities, and he has a huge increase of Latino community. And he's very supportive of them and wants to find ways how he can support the children that are in the district. And as a person that didn't speak English when I started school, I, you know, have always told my story of the fact that if it wasn't for bilingual education, it probably would have took me years to catch up with the rest of the class and probably would have cost the district even more money if we didn't do these supplemental programs that work and again, decrease the cost of us trying to get these kids graduated and successful.
Let's go back to the letter that was written to the four big names in Washington. What kind of response have you and the others gotten so far from this letter?
Well, positive responses from a lot of groups that we've been working with for years, and to see our not only city council members and, again, school board members, county commissioners come together on an issue on the federal level, it's very much inspiring them to keep going and keep fighting. I know that residents in my community are constantly asking me, when is it going to happen? When is it finally going to happen? 6 years ago, I marched with them to the federal building downtown, and it was 50,000 of us. And 6 years later, we're still where we were left, and with no fix, an immigration system, with more families being torn apart and our communities just becoming just disaster zones with all those empty homes and with all those business leaders struggling to try to, support their businesses without immigration reform. It's very, very hard. I think hearing it from the business perspective as well as from the family perspective and just community perspective, they're very motivated by the fact that they can hear their local elected officials get involved on such an important issue.
What about the folks to whom the letter is addressed, those four top senators and representatives? Has there been any response whatsoever?
Not that I know of. I know they've gotten a number of letters, including ours, but I think it was important for them to hear our voices, not just their fellow congressional members, but also the voices of the people, again, back home that we all represent.
Representative Rashida Tlaib, is this the year immigration reform is going to happen?
I hope. I pray. It's been awful to see what's happened to our communities. Just the other day, hearing a mother talk about the fact that her husband was deported a few months before and that she had to take a night shift, and her two U.S. citizen children were caught in a fire, and one of them actually died because she could not afford to take a different shift and have the people downstairs watching the children. And she struggles to this day to think, should she have stayed? should she have taken that shift? But then she thought, why take my children out of school? Where else are they going to go to school back home? Where are they going to get this type of education? I just think that if somebody is willing to our country, it says a lot about who we are as a country, but also it defines who we are and how we approach a mother like that, that is struggling, that's been here, she's been here over 10 years. And she made that choice because she wanted a better life for her children and for the future, for her family. And I think we need to really talk about those issues and stop talking about that they're criminals. I never see my neighbors as criminals. I see them as aspiring citizens. They one day will be like my parents, to watch their daughter or their son become a state representative, or to see their daughter contribute to changing a education system. I've seen children of immigrants see the world so differently and appreciate life in a major city that is struggling right now, to see only hope. And to me, they again bring such a different perspective on our communities across the country. And we need to recognize that and really look at it sincerely.
State Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from the 6th District, is part of Young Elected Officials Action. She joined with 55 other state and local elected officials, sending a letter to top Senate and House leaders in Washington calling for comprehensive immigration reform legislation. Thank you so much, Representative, for talking with us today.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As state lawmakers settle back in after their spring break, it's pretty clear the front and center issue is how to patch up Michigan's decaying roads. Governor Snyder made road repair a key goal, and there are so many plans and schemes being talked about to find that estimated $1.2 billion or maybe even more above what we're already spending on the roads in order to fix them. And the governor's having a time of it trying to get lawmakers to say yes to these plans, so much so he's banking on a bipartisan deal to raise the needed money. But let's go beyond that debate. Let's look further down the road to another question. How would that repair money be spent? Who'd get it? Who would get first crack at that repair money? Joining us is the Lansing reporter for the Associated Press, Dave Eggert. Dave, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And we have in the studio Eric Lufer, who's the Director of Local Affairs for the Citizens Research Council. Good to have you with us, Eric.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to start with you, Dave. You did a piece that the kind of the headline said it all, Michigan Road Debate Light on How Money Divvied Up. So here we are more than 2 months down the road since the governor unveiled his budget and road repairs are a centerpiece. Do you think Governor Snyder expected such resistance in the legislature to his plan to boost gas taxes and license plate fees?
Yes, I think he, I assume he expected it. He actually last year had made it a topic as well, although had not kind of formally gotten behind a specific plan, at least publicly. Nothing happened with it last year, so I think he kind of knew what the obstacles were going into this year.
So we're really looking at that issue of beyond getting the money and onto the questions you raised, Dave, in your story of April 7th about how do you spend the funds. So, Eric, what do you see are the major questions that need to be tackled in deciding how that road cash will be spent?
This is something that we identified about 15 years ago when Citizens Research Council did a report on highway funding. And the bottom line is the way the formula is currently set up, if you identify one particular area of need, you have to raise almost four times that amount of money to get that dollar to where it needs to be, just because everybody needs to have their share of it. Part of that is a function of we've designated the state as our raiser of money for highway funding, but part of it is just this antiquated, this is the way we've always done it, that's the way we should do it in the future system, and it just creates for a lot of inefficiency and a lot of complicated revenue-raising mechanisms.
And as you pointed out in your piece, Dave Eggert, that goes back to, what, 1951, that formula?
Originally, it has been updated, I think, a handful of times in the last 60 years. But, yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the big criticisms is that it's outdated. And, just like with any funding issue, you just get, you've got the Michigan Department of Transportation that does highways and trunk lines across the state. You've got county road agencies. You've got some money that goes to cities. You've got money that goes to public transit. So far, there's just been very little detail as to how the money would be split up, but you're going to have kind of the natural fight among all everybody wanted to kind of get their piece of the pie.
Well, in fact, I want to jump on that because we have been hearing from Michigan radio listeners who saw your piece and are intensely interested in what's going to happen with this. I'm going to share an excerpt from an email we got on the issue from one of our listeners. After reading your piece, you note, Dave, that the governor is expected to favor commercial routes to more populated areas that are key to trade and business. So our listener, Kenneth, wrote, and here's his quote, "In other words, if Governor Snyder gets his way, he wants outstate Michigan residents to fund the state trunk line road maintenance projects in and around the new bridge to Canada at the expense of outstate drivers. Educated outstate voters must be skeptical of those supporting a change in state law which will award more revenue to metro communities at the expense of rural communities." Is that fear justified in your view?
Yes, I mean, that fear is out there. I mean, again, the Governor Snyder is kind of mainly focused right now on just seeing if he can get votes to even come up with this pot of money. So they've been quiet on how he would divvy it up, but he's been calling for $1.2 billion in new revenue, and of that, $1.1 billion of it would go to something called a commercial corridor fund. The administration's quick to point out that there's important corridors in every state in the county. You know, naturally, there's kind of a fear that, and this has already come up in some legislative committees, that, you know, you've got these massive projects and that have been in the pipeline for Interstate 94 in Detroit, things like that just cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And rural communities, rural lawmakers are saying, well, why would I vote for, a road funding increase if, you know, we're not seeing some dollars here in for our roads?
Eric Lufer, from where you sit, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I don't think it's justified. As Dave just commented, mm-hmm. we do have commercial roads all throughout the state. And really what they're trying to do with this new formula is get the money to the roads where people drive on the most. So there is more traffic in southeast Michigan than the rest of the state. There is also more commercial activity. So if you want to have tax dollars to pay for the services the government needs, if you want a viable economy in the state, some of that has to come to southeast Michigan. But that's not at the exclusion of the rest of the state. US 31 serves the west side of the state. We have highways in the Upper Peninsula. We have I-75 runs the stretch of Michigan.
In fact, our listener Kenneth writes about there's the high volume of daily commuters from rural Lapeer County into Oakland County on M-24. And you have on Macomb County on M-53.
Right. So part of the governor's plan is to put some burden on local governments, let the state pay for the roads that are used the most, and if local governments have needs to fix the roads that serve your subdivision, if they need the small roads that serve less traffic, then local governments can raise taxes to pay for it. That's part of his plan, and that needs to be debated. At the same time, you're raising $1.2 million at the state level. It's going to be really hard for local governments to raise, you know, $100,000 to pay for their own needs. But that's part of the plan, and that needs to be debated.
You're right. That is not something that's really been out there
that
the public's been aware of.
I know I was talking with somebody from the County Road Association group the other day, and they point out that apparently back in the 1980s, there was some previous option that allowed local governments to try to, you know, raise a millage or do something else. They didn't have any success with that. The governor's plan would allow local governments to raise vehicle registration fees. One of the issues there is the local governments seem open to that idea. They want to be careful that the state fees don't go up so much that then it's impossible to convince local voters to also raise them higher.
It just makes one wonder how, with so many really opposite polarized views, how does Michigan move forward? And I guess the question is, for both of you, from where you sit, what is the best way? How would Michigan be best served in the way that road money is doled out and what the plan should be? What's from where you sit, Eric, what do you think?
I'm in favor of the concept of what they're trying to accomplish here. The devil's always in the details, but if the legislature met in southeast Michigan, there would be no doubt that we need more money to pay for roads. Those are the roads that are deteriorating the fastest. And if you get to upstate Michigan, you might ask, well, why do we need this? Because while those roads might be, getting bad in their view, when you compare that to southeast Michigan, it's by far much better roads. we've had efforts in the past to try to raise money for roads, and they've fallen apart because of details about who's going to get the money and who benefits from this. So it's very complicated. It's a balancing act. You have to move things forward. But it's just not clear how much longer we can go without more money for roads before we're just driving on dirt paths again, and how much economic activity you're going to have in those circumstances.
And what do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right. You know, most lawmakers around us represent more populated areas like Southeast Michigan. But yeah, you've got corridors. I-69 goes across the state. I-94, mm-hmm. Grand Rapids. I mean, there's lawmakers from a lot of these places that realize the roads need to be fixed. Probably the bigger issue for now will just be, can they get votes to actually get the money? And then this. The kind of how it's divvied up will probably be worked out in some way. I think what people are worried about is just very light on the details. And I talked to a lawmaker who voted for the gas tax increase in 1997. Gas tax was raised 4 cents, and at that time they were able to sell it, especially in the west part of the state, with a big new highway that was going to go through the area.
Yes.
And now this proposal, the governor has essentially said it's mainly a maintenance budget. I mean, they've gotten so far behind on just trying to keep up the roads that, there's not necessarily going to be some big, shiny new project that they're going to be able to promise someone in their backyard that might entice them to vote for it.
So this is basically all about kind of treading water and just maintaining, not improving, and not building, as you say, shiny new projects.
Yes. I mean, some of the roads would be improved. I think they're warning that things are just going to keep deteriorating, and when roads get worse, it just gets more expensive to fix them. So if you can kind of maintain them more now, the problem won't get as bad. I think the governor is saying that by spending $12 billion over the next decade under his plan, Michigan taxpayers would avoid a $25 billion bill later on.
Eric, does that hold up in the analysis you guys have done?
You have to maintain roads. It's one thing to build them, but regular maintenance, just like you maintain your home or any other infrastructure, regular maintenance is necessary. You can't do that all at once. You have to have a regular schedule. Let's work on this 2-mile stretch of road now, and next year we'll do the next stretch of road. So it has to be a regular cycle. And right now we don't have enough money to do that regular maintenance. And not only do we not have enough, but we don't even have enough to match the federal dollars that are offered to the state. And last year we had to dip into the general fund to come up with some of that money. So if you don't do the maintenance, it makes things worse and worse. And just like letting a health problem go, the worse it gets, the more expensive it is to fix.
And what will you both be watching for? And what should we all be watching for, especially folks that are writing us that are, very concerned about what's going to happen to the roads in their corner of Michigan? What are we watching for, Eric?
Well, as I understand it, the whole legislature is kind of watching each other. Nobody wants to get out in front on this, lest they be accused of a tax hiker. So it's going to require leadership, probably out of the governor's office, to really pull this together and a lot of meetings behind closed doors to say, look, it's all coming together, but we need you on board. And we're not likely to see that happening out in public. It's just, I think they're going to come out sometime soon, who knows when, and say, look, we've got a deal. We're ready to move with this.
Dave, what are you watching for?
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a test of the governor's legislative deal-making skills. And he has historically not been a fan of what's called horse trading. If I vote for this, you vote for that kind of deals. But in this case, this is such a big issue and such a big ask of a Republican legislator that, that their brand is no tax increases, no fee increases. The governor here is asking for tax and fee increases unless there's some other pot of money out there they can find. So I think that's what to look for, is his ability to Senate Majority Leader Randy Richelville and House Speaker Jace Bolger, their ability to come up with some sort of deal behind closed doors, most likely, and then sell it to their caucuses.
Lansing reporter for the Associated Press, Dave Eggert, and Eric Lufer, who's Director of Local Affairs for the Citizens Research Council. Dave joined us from Lansing, and Eric was kind enough to join us in the studio. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, something we hear a lot these days is the fact that kids just don't get enough playtime, enough time to kind of let their imaginations run free, time that isn't supervised, organized, micromanaged, and playtime that's all about having fun and not all about how much money you can spend. So when we spotted a book called 112 Ways for Kids to Have Fun Without Money, we were intrigued. And then we discovered the author is 12 years old, 11 when he wrote the book, and, well, we were very hooked. So joining us in the studio is author Sam Gross and his co-author and his mom, Kate. Welcome to both of you to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
Tell us, how did you come up with this list of 112 ways for kids to have fun without money?
Well, it started as a third grade computer class project where the teacher just asked us to come up with 100 plus ways to have happiness without money. And so we were all doing that when really she was like teaching us how to format a list.
And then, Kate, how did someone decide, gee, maybe we have a book here?
Well, the computer teacher also had them import their photo and write a bio. And she had them printed as a little book, not just a list on paper. Mm-hmm. I think it sat on the kitchen counter for a while, and my mom saw it, and she thought it was just something everyone should read. And she took it, as grandma's will do,
because grandmas
are big supporters.
And yes, we are.
Yes. And so she took it and, you know, had ideas that maybe we could publish it ourselves online or something. And she happened to be sitting at her book club, and a guest that day was a publisher, Marian Nelson. And so she approached her and asked if she would read it. And Marian really liked it.
And so there it is. So I'm going to give you your book, and I'd like you, if you will, Sam Gross, to give us some of the ideas that you came up with. Just pick some of your favorite ones and share them with us.
Well, I'm a big football guy, so I'm going to have to say I like the play flag football in your backyard with your family. And I also love Legos. And so the one where it says stage a battle between your Lego minifigure troops, that's one of my favorites too. And plan a party for someone for no particular reason, that one is one of my favorite ones. And especially the illustration makes it a lot better because they have the dog with the party hat on and stuff.
I think that parents everywhere, Kate, must probably want to say amen, hallelujah, to the idea of helping kids discover ways to have fun in ways that are not budget busters.
Right, right, absolutely. And I think for us, you know, I think everyone goes through times in their life where they have more money or less money. We've had ups and downs as well. And for kids, it was never a go do this, go do that, you know, especially when they were younger. It just is too cost prohibitive. So they do spend a lot of time coming up with their own games. And I think having them have that time on their own, they were able to create really fantastic things that if we'd been rush or paying to go do this or buy the latest thing, they wouldn't have had time to do, you know.
Sam, what do you hope that other kids will get out of reading your book?
Well, I really don't want people to be bored because being bored is a choice and you don't have to make that choice to be bored. You're always, always able to create your own fun.
And Kate, how about you? What are you hoping parents will get from reading Sam's book?
I guess it's pretty much along the same lines. I love technology, but I'm a big limiter on technology. I think a half hour is good because it kind of shuts down a lot of creative thinking. So I hope parents realize that take those skills. It's great. All kids need them. But take time away from that to let them invent their own way. They can be in charge of some of their own activities.
The book is 112 Ways for Kids to Have Fun Without Money. It's published by Fern Press. Sam Gross is the author, sixth grader from Flushing, and his co-author and mom, Kate Gross, joined us in the studio. And you can learn more about the book. Go to his website. It's samgrossbooks.com. Easy to find. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Keith Taylor, poet and writer here in Michigan. We're going to talk to him about his picks for local spring weather reads. But first, it's kind of hard to talk about spring without wondering just what is up with spring this year. It arrived March 20th, at least that's what the calendars told us. But I think it's safe to say most of us here in Michigan agree spring has been more than a little bit shy about making its presence known to us. Let's turn now to Dr. Jeff Masters, director Director of Meteorology at Weather Underground, to get a reading on this moody, cranky spring. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's certainly been a slow show spring.
It has. You know, I'm just looking at the week ahead for Ann Arbor, printed off the forecast. So 67 for today's high, then a rainy 52 Wednesday, a rainy thunderstormy 71 on Thursday, and then back to 50 on Friday, and all through the weekend, maybe 50 for a high. What is up?
You didn't mention the fact that we're going to probably see some snow flurries on Saturday, and then it's going to be a hard freeze Sunday morning. And what's up is the jet stream has just been stuck in this very winter-like pattern. It's been unusually persistent. It's just had this long sort of bend to the south that's allowed all of this cold air from Canada to funnel southwards.
So it's the darn jet stream. Because I was wondering, was it just that we had a kind of a warp perspective from last year in March 2012 when we were actually looking at the 80s around Easter? Or this really is a colder later spring?
Yes, it really is. I mean, March temperatures over the state of Michigan were in the coldest one-third of all Marches since the late 1800s. And last year, they were the record warmest. So wait a year and you get something completely different.
Well, in fact, is that, we talk about what's normal and what's not normal when it comes to our weather, but we're Michigan. Is there really a normal, or do we just take whatever Mother Nature dishes out and that's our normal bouncing around?
Certainly in the spring and in the fall, the Midwest weather has wild extremes, and Michigan being where it is, it tends to get some pretty crazy weather in the spring. But that being said, I've been a meteorologist 30 years and never seen the kind of wild swings in weather that we've experienced over the last 3 years.
That's interesting. The big question, I'm seeing it on Facebook, is, come on, Mother Nature, thanks a lot, spring. So what do you think, Jeff Masters, what's your outlook for the rest of spring, and when can we put these sweaters away?
We really don't have any skill making long-range weather predictions more than about 2 weeks in advance, so I'm hesitant to say when this is going to end. Certainly over the next 2 weeks, we expect below-average temperatures. I don't see the jet stream, you know, shifting out of this kind of stuck pattern it's been in, but it's got to happen eventually, right? I mean, summer does come, so I still think we got to be prepared for frosts in May this year.
Boy, oh boy. So keep that in mind when we're planting our flowers and putting those out in the yard. And I will just say, speaking personally, I'd still rather put a hoodie or a sweater on and have it be on the cool side than suffer through 95 and humid. Maybe it's just a middle-aged woman thing, but I'm not complaining as much as maybe some other folks are about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be a little grateful that this is somewhat normalish weather for the Midwest and for Michigan. I mean, it beats last year having a week of 80 in March and having all the fruit trees bloom and then get frozen by the subsequent frosts. And it beats the kind of drought conditions we had last year, which helped the Great Lakes go to their record lowest level. So we should be a little bit grateful, I think, for some normalish cool weather.
We'll take it. Dr. Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology at Weather Underground. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Cynthia.
So let's now welcome in, or at least try and welcome in, spring with a jump start on our reading lists. Let's call them books to induce a nice case of spring fever. For that, we call on poet and writer Keith Taylor. He coordinates the undergrad program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. Keith, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. Good to be here.
Well, so the last time you were on the program, you brought us great suggestions for our long winter's reading list. So what have you got to get us in mood for spring?
I thought this time I'd talk about short novels, even novellas. Because, you know, after all, we should be getting outside, right?
We should.
And we should be working in the garden. Even for those people like me who like to read outdoors, it's still a little brisk, as you've just said.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't want to start Anna Karenina sitting
no.
outside.
Right, and this now. Isn't the sit on the beach, fall into
exactly.
a cheesy novel kind of list
exactly.
that we want for July.
Right. So these are short ones
okay.
that will let you get outdoors and spend some time out there.
Okay. So start us off.
Certainly. The first one I want to talk about is Jim Harrison. Jim Harrison, in some ways, is probably Michigan's best-known writer. I'm always surprised, though, by Michigan readers who don't know him. It startles me because he's written 20, 25 novels or bits of fiction and wonderful books of poems. But I envy those readers a little bit because they've got a lot to discover. Harrison's getting old now, and he left the state a few years ago, both for his grandchildren and for his health.
Mm.
For years, I've heard of him being ill and getting frail, and then suddenly
here comes a book.
You know, How does it happen? And the books are often very good as he's ever been. So, you know, his 70s, now his late 70s, haven't slowed him down. For instance, this spring he published The River Swimmer, just a couple of weeks ago. Two novellas collected under one cover. He's published several of these over the years, by the way. Probably the best known one is Legends of the Fall, and it's best known because it was an early vehicle for Brad Pitt.
It was. I actually own that.
Really?
I do. Good. Anthony Hopkins, yeah. Aidan Quinn. Oh, yeah, I'm on it.
Read the novella. It'll take less time than watching the movie.
It was a long
great,
movie.
It's a great story.
Okay.
The River Swimmer has two of these in it. The first one's about an art historian who's embittered by too many years in the city and among cynics and cynics in his academic program. We don't know about those people.
No, what? There's no cynics right. in academia.
And he finally returns to his family's battered Michigan farm, where he rediscovers the things that drew him to art in the first place.
Mm.
Beautiful story. But what I really want to talk about is the title piece. The River Swimmer is a great example of something Harrison's always been able to do.
And that's what?
He creates a story that feels absolutely real, yet it's got the strong magical or mysterious element in it. Sometimes I call it Midwestern magical realism.
Okay.
A lot of other people have tried it, but nobody does it as well as he does.
So
it's great.
What's going on in this?
So it's a story about a young man in northern Michigan, of course, and he's drawn to the water, always drawn to the water. I don't want to give the plot away, really, but it's enough to say that he swims everywhere.
Nobody likes a spoiler.
No, exactly. And I try not to spoil it.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's an early passage from the book.
Okay, just to give us a taste.
And this is how he, this is where he discovers his swimming, and also where, I'll go from that to where he discovers his magic.
Okay.
His biggest special thrill was when his father fished the river in a rowboat with a small motor and let Thad swim at the end of a long rope to keep the current from sweeping him away. For a slender swimmer's body, his chest grew very large, as often happens. Luckily, his school didn't have a swim team, or he would have become a worthless star athlete, though he drew the attention of the university when he swam to shore from the Manitou Islands and Beaver Island in Lake Michigan. To be frank, he could not stop himself, and that was his downfall. I don't recommend swimming from Beaver Island to, it is what, 24, 25
yeah,
miles in or something?
Just can't believe it. Yeah.
But here, during one of his swims, this is where he gets that little magical element. Of course, the character Thad has been beat up by a girlfriend's father, so
Ooh.
You know he might be addled a little bit.
Okay.
But he's back swimming again because swimming always heals him. A devout student of natural history, he received the shock of his life when he reached the lagoon. The lagoon had always offered a great concentration of frogs and polywogs, and now they were traveling in thick, shimmering circles. Here and there, a water baby would swim in, sip and swallow a polywog with a smile. They were about 8 inches long, with normal baby features and dark hair and pinkish skin. Thad shouted under the surface and choked on water. He was so frightened, he threw himself up on the bank, sobbing for breath. He'd never been more confused and was shaking from head to toe.
Ooh.
So suddenly, the water babies show up.
Water babies.
Now, they don't become absolutely essential to the story, but they're always there.
And so you have your magic.
What are the water babies?
Water babies. Yeah, when you said water baby, I'm like,
is that
a snake I haven't heard about?
Exactly. I thought that too.
Yes.
Yeah, which is very odd.
So that is The River Swimmer by Jim Harrison.
It is indeed.
Okay.
So he's still around. He's still putting out books. And, we can be thankful for
that. And as I look at it, it is a very, as you say, a slim tome. So it can be done without a huge falling into...
Right.
Into time.
Right. You could take it and be comfortable in the easy chair.
Excellent.
The back porch. But that little magical moment got me ready for a poet. In spring, I always like to go back to the old Michigan poet, Theodore Retke, who was probably our first major poet. He was born in 1908, died in 1963. He was from Saginaw, where his family owned greenhouses. Now, Retke wrote poems about those greenhouses, and they got kind of well known. There are people in the world, in the English-speaking world, who don't think Ford Motor Company, when they hear Michigan, they think Retke Greenhouses because of these poems. Not a lot of people,
but there are some.
Out there. I want to read a short one, which is called Child on Top of a Greenhouse. In this poem, just imagine a little boy who's climbed onto the roof of one of his family's greenhouses. Below him, everybody is freaking out.
Okay.
Both because they're worried about the little boy and, of course, they're worried about the greenhouse because it's made of glass.
That's right, crashing
in. So here's this tiny little poem.
Okay.
Child on Top of a Greenhouse. The wind billowing out the seat of my britches, my feet crackling splinters of grass and dried putty. the half-grown chrysanthemums staring up like accusers, up through the street glass, flashing with sunlight, a few white clouds all rushing eastward, a line of elms plunging and tossing like horses, and everyone, everyone pointing up and shouting. Tiny little poem.
I love it.
Isn't it beautiful?
Like flashing like accusers.
Yeah.
You know, when you read poetry, I get it. I'm one of those that when I try to read it, it doesn't hook me. I hear you read it. So you have to just...
Well, maybe you should read it out loud from now.
Well, maybe that's...
You do have a good voice.
Probably what it's meant to be done, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah, that's beautiful. So that is...
That's Theodore Retke poems.
Okay.
And a young writer up in Saginaw named Jeff Van Zandt just wrote a novel last year, a short little novel called American Poet. It was actually picked as one of the Michigan Notable Books of the Year for this year, so he'll be traveling around the state.
Okay.
In that novel, a young man tries to live the life of a poet in Saginaw, which, of course, is another one of our cities in economic decline, offering few ways to make a living, certainly not for young poets. And this young poet, as they often do, goes a little crazy, and he tries to defend Retke's childhood home from being destroyed.
Okay.
He ends up on the roof of the house, just like the kid in the poem.
All right.
And he's shouting at the passersby that they need to save the poem. It's a wonderful scene. And you know, the young poet might even succeed. There is, by the way, a group in Saginaw who's worked very hard to save Retke's home.
So that's Jeff Van Zandt.
Jeff Van Zandt, American poet.
Mm.
One last novella, Gloria Wayland, wonderful woman. She's been around a long time. She won a National Book Award decades ago for a young adult novel. But she's kept writing fiction. She was living up north, and she came back to the greater Detroit area as she got a little older. I think she's in her 80s now.
Mm.
But she's still publishing. She's still working very hard on these stories. This is a collection that came together of stories and a novella. Novella's about 110 pages long. The whole collection is called Living Together.
So we've got short stories and a novella. Okay.
Right. And the novella, you know, as I said, 110 pages.
Yeah.
It's called Keeping Your Place. One of the things about Gloria, it's great. We've often heard that American literature is a literature about adolescents or about people who refuse to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's really true or not, but I do find it very refreshing to read these stories by Gloria Wayland and learn about people who have earned their sorrow and their joys.
All right, so who have some seasoning.
Exactly. In this novella, a widow returns to her family's cottage in northern Wisconsin, and her ambitious daughter drops off two city-raised stepdaughters to stay with her. They start out
having
good attentions, of course, but finally the grandmother and the granddaughters learn to live together.
Does this echo a little of On Golden Pond?
It does a little bit.
Yeah.
It does a little
bit.
Yeah, yeah. And they learn to appreciate the place. It's filled with these little gem-like moments. Here's just her arrival right at the beginning. Her stay at the cabin would be a lonely one, for her children were scattered. But when have children in one way or another not returned home? She carried provisions into the cabin, as she'd done hundreds of times, and put them on known shelves. The kitchen had both an electric and a wood stove, so you were free to choose your era. There were beer and wine ads on the assorted glasses, as if the family had spent the last half century carousing. Stuck on the wall, a Land of Lakes butter carton with its Indian maiden seen against an idyllic land of water and trees served as a miniature landscape. So there, you know, and she goes on and talks about the books that they keep at the cabin. So, you know, there's a lovely sort of, you know, we can read this to get ready for your week or two or three.
Up north?
If you're lucky enough.
But it's very much, you can, almost like a screenplay. I could see it.
Yeah, that's the
very,
idea.
Very good like that.
Yeah, and most of us in Michigan at least have some sense of that. So.
Yes, we do. And that is
Gloria Whalen. And the book is called Living Together. The novella at the end of it is called Keeping Your Place.
And she actually, I note that she's noted for writing for young readers.
She did. She won one of the big national awards for it. But that's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But she's stayed restless and active and thinking. And you know, she's a model for us all.
As you talk to us, Keith Taylor, about these writers, and we have you were saying Jeff Van Zandt is quite young. You've got people on the whole spectrum. It does make you kind of stop and realize that it is a lifelong process, that writers don't just appear on the bookshelves at the bookstore.
Absolutely.
And you really keep going and going and going.
That's the hope.
That's the hope.
I'm still going at whatever I'm at. And the hope is that I can keep going. And like Gloria Wayland, keep trying new things, at least new things for me. And Jim Harrison, just exploring all the time, keeping active and keeping thinking.
Well, tell us, what have you been writing?
Oh, I keep working on poems. I actually just published a new tiny little chapbook of poems with a little press here in Ann Arbor called The Ancient Murrelet.
And tell us what that's about.
The ancient murrelet is a bird. It's a bird from the North Pacific. And one found its way to Lake Michigan a few years back. So all the bird watchers went crazy. My book of poems is about home, about the loss of home, about trying to refind home. Sort of a lot of the things that concern these writers.
All right, let's recap our reading list then.
Okay, it's Jim Harrison, two novellas under one title called The River Swimmer. Jeff Van Zandt, a little novel called American Poet. And Gloria Whalen, a collection of short stories called Living Together. And then, of course, I also did a poem from Theodore Retke, whose poems are around in most Michigan bookstores.
Poet and writer Keith Taylor coordinates the undergrad program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. And you can find his reading list suggestions. Just go to our website. You can go to the stateside link at michiganradio.org. Keith, always a pleasure.
And for me too, Cindy.